This weekend starts right after this.
Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, Geico makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. Geico.com. Easy.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Workplace anxieties grow. I'm Jennifer Kashinka on This Weekend. Here's what we have for you this hour. With COVID numbers rising again, our stress levels are also rising. We'll take a look at the latest rules for the workplace. You may think you're just a regular fan, but watching sports can make you happier, healthier, and more understanding. If you need to share proof of your vaccine, there are easy ways to store it on your phone. And we're living in a golden age of the dinosaur chicken nugget.
There's a lot of care that goes into forming nuggets, making sure that it can be recognizable and also that it's easy for children to eat without having to cut it up. So there's all sorts of interesting considerations that go into these.
Ellen Byron of the Wall Street Journal will have that story in about 20 minutes. COVID numbers are up again, and so are our stress levels. Just a couple of months after things seem to be returning to some level of normalcy, many workers are concerned about their company's rush to get back into the workplace. Here with more is Noam Scheiber, who's written an article for The New York Times called Workers' Anxiety Grows as COVID Variant Casts a Shadow. Noam, why are people getting nervous again?
Well, beyond the obvious, you know, proliferation of the Delta variants and all the stories that we've been hearing about breakthrough cases, which means that people who thought they were protected after getting vaccinated may not be as protected as they hoped. I think there's just this sense that a lot of plans that employers made to get back to normal were made when things were looking good, when infection rates were really dropping, vaccination rates were rising. And now that we're living in a world that's pretty different from that world, a lot of workers feel like employers haven't adjusted. They're sticking with those same plans that they made 2 or 3 months ago, and they're kind of rushing to get back to normal. And if you combine that with the rise in infection rates and the sense that the vaccine isn't really protecting us the way we thought, it's really freaking a lot of people out.
A couple of times over the last year, companies have pushed their start dates of getting people back in the office several times by several months. The latest seemed to be a general feeling that a lot of companies would come back as soon as Labor Day ended. Do you think those plans will change yet again?
You know, I definitely think they will to some extent. I've talked to a number of employers in the past week or two, and it's, you know, it's very much a moving target. The conversations I've had in the last 2 weeks suggest that a lot of employers are still going to try to aim for that kind of post Labor Day return, but they're not going to be kind of fundamentalists about it. If the Delta variant is still spreading rapidly, they will reassess. But I think they're still hoping at this point to kind of continue with these plans and just allow a little bit of flexibility. Obviously, we've seen an increase in vaccine mandates, employers telling workers that they have to get vaccinated or get tested weekly or more than weekly if they want to come back. So I think a lot of employers, despite the increase in infection rates and the concerns about the vaccine, are still hoping that this target and just kind of take additional measures to protect people while still sticking to that timetable. You know, again, if things really go off the rails, I think they're prepared to reassess. But I think more often than not, I've heard that employers are still going to try to kind of hit that rough target.
We're speaking with Noam Scheiber, who's written an article for The New York Times about the anxiety workers are facing going back to the office. In general, with the people you've spoken to, how are vaccine mandates being perceived?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I think you have an interesting response from unions who generally have been very pro-vaccine and have undertaken a lot of education to try to get their members vaccinated. So it's not a question so much on the part of workers and unions of whether the vaccine is a good thing, but there is a concern about just kind of procedural fairness is maybe the term I would use, that there may be people who have legitimate reasons to not get vaccinated, whether it's health complications, whether it's just access to the vaccine. And the unions are very concerned, and by extension a lot of their members and workers are concerned, that the mandate will somehow be used to treat workers unfairly. They'll get disciplined, even fired, if they don't get the vaccine when, in fact, they have very legitimate reasons not to. So I think that's going to be the fight in the next few weeks as these mandates kind of proliferate. You know, I think the flip side, unions are kind of political institutions, and they, you know, are sensitive to kind of a political backlash. If it's seen as unions blocking an increase in vaccination rates, I suspect they will reassess too and kind of ease off on their skepticism.
Your story notes that some Amazon workers were upset that some barriers have come down, some distancing measures have kind of been relaxed in the last couple of months. Are there concerns with people going back about how companies are handling that kind of thing?
Yeah, again, I think this is of a piece of companies having made plans a few months ago when the world was, you know, when the trend lines were looking good and the world looked like a different place, to kind of gradually ramp down these distancing measures. Amazon also said that it was ramping down testing. Since last September, they've had, to their credit, free on-site testing for all employees at all their warehouses. So, you know, hundreds of thousands of people had access to free testing. They've said that they're going to ramp that down in late July. And some workers are really concerned about that because they're ramping this down precisely at a moment when infection rates are escalating. So I do think it gets back to that same point that the plans that were made when the world looked like it was becoming a safer place may not fit a moment when we're on a different part of the curve. And that is raising stress levels.
Noam Schreiber, who's written an article for The New York Times about worker anxiety. Coming up, why watching sports makes us happier.
This is a metaphor for your business's journey. Sometimes it feels like the world is throwing everything it has at you, and to succeed, you need someone to guide you through. That's what Dell Technologies Advisors do. They have the tech advice to help you navigate whatever challenges you're up against and get you safely to where you want to be. Call an advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL and do more with modern devices and Windows 10 Pro.
I'm Jennifer Kishinka, in for Gordon Deal. Being a sports fan isn't just fun, it's good for us individually and is a force for positive change in society. So says Larry Olmsted, New York Times and Washington Post bestselling author of Fans, How to Watch Sports Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and a Lot More Understanding. Larry, why did you decide to write this book?
I actually came to it from a different angle. I went to a baseball game years ago and saw a couple of parents who had dressed their little kids in T-shirts with obscenities on them directed at the other team. And I left the game thinking, you know, what's wrong with people? What is it? Is there something about sports that makes us crazy or bad people? So I decided to do some research. And as soon as I dove into that research, I saw that the reality was the complete opposite. And the reason those people stood out to me so much and I didn't notice the other 50,000 people was because they were really the outliers. And the majority of sports fans are much more well-adjusted. So once I saw all this data that was so surprising to me, I thought it would be surprising to other people as well.
What kind of research did you look at?
There is a whole sector of sports psychology that studies fans and fandom. So I looked at a lot of those studies from around the world, talked to leading sports psychologists. But also, you know, as I kind of broadened it, because it's not just about our psychological health, it's about, you know, history and things like the civil rights movement. So I talked to historians, professors, academics, diplomats, ambassadors, government officials, people in the sports industry, and lots of fans.
Larry, how does watching sports or being a big fan make us happier and healthier?
Well, there are about two dozen different mental health benefits that psychologists have identified that sports fans enjoy at higher rates than the rest of the population. Things like higher self-esteem and lower rates of depression. And most of those come from the feeling of community that being a sports fan provides. Humans are, in our DNA, tribal animals. We have always wanted to group together into social units. And Sports Fandom allows that in a way that has no barriers to entry. You don't have to take a test or be recommended or pay a fee or pass any kind of application to be a sports fan. You just are a fan of your team. And once you're a fan of your team, you feel like you belong to something. And one of the things I learned is that's why we refer to sports fans of particular teams in this country as kind of fill-in-the-blank nation, you know, Raiders Nation, Red Sox Nation, and you don't use that for, say, you know, fans of Harry Potter or Twilight movies, and it's because the fandom is so comprehensive and encompassing that it is like being a member of your own country.
We're speaking with Larry Olmsted, author of the book Fans. Is there a difference between somebody who just likes to sit around and, for example, watch all of the things that are happening in the Olympics and someone who's connected to a very specific team?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the sports psychologists define a sports fan as someone who follows a team. But the reality is that the studies have shown that most sports fans follow 4 to 5 different sports and different teams. So, in theory, you could be a fan of just an individual sport like tennis or golf and nothing else, and you would sort of be an exception to the fandom rule of teams, but there's very few people like that because most people who watch golf or tennis also watch other things. The Olympics are interesting in that they are an event that gets a lot of people who wouldn't be considered sports fans to watch, but even during that period, you see a lot of the same effects. You know, people are overjoyed when Simone Biles returns and competes, even if they don't watch gymnastics. And that's sort of, you know, one of the powers of sports is it has this incredible emotional connection, even if you're not an avid fan.
Larry, I find it fascinating. Your book says fans have better language skills and college students who follow sports have higher GPAs. How does that factor in?
Yeah, that's a little bit of a chicken and an egg thing. I mean, the kind of prevailing wisdom on that is that, you know, when you go to college, for most people, it's sort of the biggest, most intimidating change in their life. The first time, you know, maybe they're living away from home, and suddenly, even if they're good students, they're thrust into a more competitive environment with a lot of other good students, and it can be daunting. And because sports fans are more outgoing and have better social skills, a lot of those mental health benefits that I described have to do with peers and social acceptance. They just tend to, I think, fit in better and adjust better, and that's why they get higher grades. Now, it's not that, you know, watching football makes you better at history.
Larry Olmsted, author of Fans. Coming up, the scoop on Dino Nuggets.
Innovation. Resilience. Agility. It's how Michigan businesses work together and continue to build the future. Our expertise, talented workforce, and collaborative environment are making a difference now and shaping the future. Join us and make your mark where it matters. Visit michiganbusiness.org/radio to put your plans in motion. That's michiganbusiness.org/radio.
This portion of the program is brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The businesses of the future are being built today, and Michigan is where they start. Learn more by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity. We're living in the golden age of dinosaur chicken nuggets. And as Ellen Byron of the Wall Street Journal tells us, these fun nuggets are a lot harder to make than you may think. Ellen, what's so hard about making a Tyrannosaurus Rex chicken nugget?
It's remarkable. So there is so much attention paid to the proportions. I talked to a handful of food companies about how they tried to get the length of the neck and the tail on a Brontosaurus to be roughly the right length compared to its body, or those spikes on the back of a Stegosaurus, getting decipherable spikes along the back when you're working with a breaded meat is not easy.
So do they have people who are working on crazy things like this all the time, or is this a one-off?
No, I get the impression that that there are people regularly devoted to developing novelty-shaped foods inside food companies. And I talked to someone at Purdue, for example, and prior to his position at Purdue, where he has been working with different fun shapes of nuggets, he worked for Campbell's Soup Company designing fun-shaped noodles. And there's a lot of care that goes into forming nuggets, making sure that it can be recognizable, and also that it's easy for children to eat. and without having to cut it up. So there's all sorts of interesting considerations that go into these.
Yeah, your story talks about a nugget shape, weight, and density. So a lot of things have to be measured.
It does. One of the ways you can really see this at play is a cheesy tot called that looks like what we know as Baby Yoda from The Mandalorian. On the show, the name is Grogu. A brand called Farm Rich worked hard to be able to make points at the ends of Baby Yoda's ears, and also to get the ear to head ratio just right, but keep the bite right at around an ounce in size so that children could easily eat them. Developing pointy edges is particularly difficult for people who work with tots and nuggets because, again, you're working with breading.
We're speaking with Ellen Byron of the Wall Street Journal. I guess along those same lines, you don't want pieces of these foods to break off easily.
That's right. That is a big indicator of quality. And so there's a lot of tests that go on to make sure that after they're flash frozen, they can be dropped into packaging, that they can withstand shipping. So they need to take care that any kind of points or edges can basically survive all of those different stages of manufacturing and shipping.
Ellen, in general terms, why are chicken nuggets of any sort so popular now?
Food companies tell me that there's two reasons. One is children were home so much during the pandemic that they ate more lunches at home, and parents looking to cheer up those homeschoolers were buying a lot of novelty-shaped nuggets. And then on top of that, young adults especially are craving dinosaur-shaped nuggets. You can even see it online. If you want to give yourself a midday smile, go to a website like Etsy and type in dinosaur nuggets, and you will see a whole world of crafts just devoted to dinosaur nuggets. A lot of young people say that they feel nostalgia and some quirky, you know, joy when they buy these foods that they grew up eating.
Ellen Byron of the Wall Street Journal. It's coming up on 30 minutes past the hour on This Weekend.
Staying sharp is how businesses stay successful. But the guys at Harry's, they took it literally. Their business stays sharp because their products do. In a recent study, Harry's customers said their eighth shave was as smooth as their first. Redeem a Harry's trial set when you go to harrys.com/deal and see if you agree. They craft their blades in their own German factory to make sure they meet their high standards. They're so confident in them, they offer a 100% money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. And the bottom line is you get a great shave and end up looking pretty sharp as a result. Harry's is giving their best offer to our listeners. New Harry's customers can redeem a starter set for just $3 at harrys.com/deal. You'll get a 5-blade razor, a weighted handle, foaming shave gel with aloe, and a travel cover to protect your blades when you're on the go. That's a $13 value for just $3. There's never been a better time to try Harry's. Visit harrys.com/deal to try Harry's today.
Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal on This Weekend. Coming up in the next half hour, how to store your vaccination card on your phone in a safe, convenient way. When it comes to money management, there are some good rules to follow. We'll have a rundown. For men, T-shirts with a suit are back, a la Miami Vice. And there's a new trend at the Tokyo Olympics, bus spotting. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Now that New York City is requiring proof of vaccination to get into restaurants, gyms, and some indoor entertainment venues, you may find yourself needing to share proof of your vaccine at other places. How can you do that? Brent Molina of USA Today has some answers. Brent, what's the problem with carrying around the card?
Two things. First off, the card isn't exactly built to carry around very easily. It's kind of big. You can carry it probably in a bag or a purse, but if you have a wallet, it's going to be really challenging. So there's that part of it. The other part of it, too, is, you set up the possibility of losing your card, which makes it even more challenging because then once you lose that, it can become a little bit of a difficult issue trying to get a new one and try to just have a new way to prove that you've been vaccinated.
Brett, your first suggestion is that we should take a picture of it. Why?
Well, that's the easiest way that you can have proof that you've been vaccinated, and that way you can keep your card at home. One caveat, though, if you're planning to take a picture and put it on your phone, is you want to put it in a separate album, because, you know, one thing that can happen is if you're taking pictures of family and vacation and other stuff, it's going to get lost in that camera roll. So if you need to pull it up quickly, it's going to be really hard to find. And on iPhone, for example, you can put it in a hidden album, and that can just be there by itself and allows you quickly to get in there and tap that link and access the card right away.
Are there other good ways to put it on your smartphone where you can find it quickly?
Yeah, if you own an Android phone, you can actually create a locked folder, and you can, take a picture of it and store it in that locked folder and put it behind a passcode. On iPhone, if you want similar security, you can actually use the Notes app and scan it like you would using a scanner, and then you can lock that note as well, and that can allow you to have a little more security if you want to keep your COVID card there. There are also other apps and other services that some states are using. New Jersey, for example, has the Docket app that they use where residents can view their vaccine status. New York has the Excelsior Pass. But then we're seeing other companies introduce some stuff as well. Walmart, for example, announced that they're going to allow access to digital COVID records through accounts on Walmart or Sam's Club. There's also a service called VaxYes, which allows you to put in your information, and then it'll transform your card into a digital passport, and then you can add it to a wallet if you're using an app like, say, a Google Pay or an Apple Wallet.
We're speaking with Brett Molina of USA Today. Brett, in talking to some of the people you did for your story, are there any concerns about fake cards or people using something that doesn't belong to them?
Well, I think that is, you know, that is something that does come up. And that's what, you know, that's what's challenging, I think, about the process is, you know, you get these cards from your pharmacy usually or wherever you go to get your vaccine. And they're kind of official, but they're not, you know, they're not official to the level of, say, a driver's license, for example, where you get that issued to you from the state. This is something that, again, you get right after your vaccine. It's handwritten most of the time. So there is a little bit of concern there related to that, because there is no real kind of concrete kind of driver's license level way to author to show that you've gotten vaccinated.
Are there concerns about privacy or security when you're putting this kind of a document on your phone?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, VaxYes, for example, they've noted that all the data that you input into their service is encrypted, and they're also compliant with HIPAA, which is the law that governs how healthcare professionals have to store and protect your data. So for the services that do, you know, offer this, that's something you want to look out for if they're following HIPAA, and also what kind of encryption they're using. And obviously, if you're using taking a picture, for example, on your phone, that's why it's good to have a hidden album, or you're able to lock down that card behind a folder or behind a note, for example, so that way you have a little bit extra security there. Say if you're letting someone use your phone and they just want to look at pictures, it kind of keeps your card safe.
Brett Molina of USA Today. Coming up, tips for saving and spending.
Do you love seafood when you're out to eat but never make it for yourself at home? Yeah, me too. But the key to restaurant quality at home starts with high-quality seafood and simple techniques from Wild Alaskan Company. With Wild Alaskan Company, you're getting high-quality, sustainably sourced, wild-caught seafood delivered right to your door. Choose from salmon, whitefish, or a combination. Money back if you're not happy. I went with the Wild Combo Box. Fired it up on the grill with a little garlic, lemon, and parsley. It was like sitting at some dockside restaurant in the last frontier. Each piece of fish was individually wrapped and labeled. Plus, the packaging can be composted. Wild Alaskan Company seafood is always wild, never farmed or modified, and contains no antibiotics. It's how nature intended it. And right now, you can get $15 off your first box of premium seafood when you visit wildalaskancompany.com/Gordon. That's wildalaskancompany.com/Gordon for $15 off your first box. wildalaskancompany.com/Gordon.
When it comes to money management, there are no hard and fast rules, but Jonathan Clements, founder of HumbleDollar.com, has some strong suggestions. Jonathan, let's start with cash. Why should we hold less of it?
One of your goals in managing your money should be to minimize the amount of cash that you hold. Yes, if you've got expenses coming in the next 5 years, or you've got an emergency fund, that should probably be in cash investments like savings accounts, money market funds, certificates of deposit. But the fact is, any money you have in cash is likely to lose ground once inflation and taxes are figured in. So, to the extent possible, try to minimize the amount of money that you have in cash investments.
Why is it important to invest in things you understand?
Complexity is really an excuse for Wall Street to charge you unnecessarily high fees. People love to own complicated investments. I mean, hedge funds are a classic example. These are certainly investments that come with bragging rights at the country club. But in terms of bragging rights about your investment performance, that's far less likely, because once those high fees are subtracted from your returns, you're likely to find that you would have done much better with a plain vanilla S&P 500 index fund.
Jonathan, you talk about maximizing tax deferral and maximizing compounding. Talk about those.
Well, let's start with tax deferral first, Jennifer. To maximize tax deferral, what you want to do is to put money into your employer's 401k plan, to put money into IRAs. And that way, when you do that, you're getting tax deduction today. But yes, when the money gets pulled out in retirement, you're going to owe income taxes on the money which you pull out. But if you do the math, what you find is that the initial tax deduction often effectively pays the final tax bill. A lot of people think IRAs, 401ks are not a great deal because of that future tax bill. But if you do the math, it actually works out in your favor, and in a sense, you end up getting tax-free growth. Meanwhile, in terms of compounding, there are two key things you need to do in order to make sure that you get the most from compounding. One is to start saving as early in life as you can, and to encourage future generations to start saving and investing as early in life as possible. And second, you need to diversify. Why is diversifying so important? One of the killers of compounding are big investment losses. If you have a big investment loss, it's really difficult to come back from that. For instance, if you lose 50%, it takes 100% gain to get back to even. To avoid those big hits, what you need to do is to diversify. And that means you want to buy mutual funds or exchange-traded funds, and you want to buy those funds that are broadly diversified so you don't suffer that big hit that individual stocks can suffer.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, founder of HumbleDollar.com. A couple of your other suggestions kind of go hand in hand. You say to minimize debt and also minimize your possessions. I think those go together.
Well, certainly, when people buy a lot of possessions, they do it with credit card debt. Of course, you know, the nice thing about credit card debt is you get the item today, unfortunately, down the road, you're going to get the bill. You want to avoid unnecessary credit card debt. If you can't pay off that balance at the end of the month, the interest charges are astronomical. So to the extent possible, you want to minimize debt. You don't want to take on more debt than is absolutely necessary. In terms of possessions, the problem with possessions is, yeah, we get an initial thrill when we buy them, but within a couple of weeks, they often end up in the basement because that initial thrill has passed, we're no longer that interested in it, and suddenly, where are they? They're in the basement, and if only we could bring ourselves to throw them out, but often we don't. It just clutters the basement, and it's a reminder of the bad purchase we made weeks and months and sometimes decades ago.
Jonathan Clements, founder of HumbleDollar.com. Up next, the Miami Vice Look is back.
This is a metaphor for your business's journey. Sometimes it feels like you're going 100 miles an hour, barely keeping up. But to cruise through challenges, you need someone who's right there with you. That's what Dell Technologies advisors do. They have the tech advice you need to get past whatever's in front of you and get to where you want to go. Call an advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL and do more with modern devices and Windows 10 Pro.
For men, the Miami Vice Look is back with a twist. Let's talk about it with Jacob Gallagher of the Wall Street Journal. Jacob, are guys dressing down a bit even when going out on the town?
You know, yeah. I mean, the simplest answer is yes. And a lot of people peg that to the pandemic and coronavirus and what have you, but you know, we've kind of been on this slope for years now, and you know, the loose way to peg it is to say, like, okay, this all kind of started with, you know, IBM and in the 80s letting their workers kind of have casual Friday, wear jeans to the office, and then kind of slowly that spreads across all corporate America, and then eventually the status of the suit is questioned as a whole. That's kind of the, like, 2-second explanation. But I also think that what really happened was, you know, the rise of Silicon Valley and kind of the acceleration of the importance of Silicon Valley companies, you know, Twitter and Facebook and what have you, within the American business landscape. You know, you have figures like Steve Jobs And then you have someone like Mark Zuckerberg, where they're not known for wearing suits. And, you know, we know with both of them that it was a deliberate decision. You know, there's early footage of a very natty-looking Steve Jobs in double-breasted suits and bow ties that no one seems to remember anymore, and he kind of made the conscious choice to wear jeans and a turtleneck. And then you definitely have Mark Zuckerberg, inspired by him, wearing hoodies, and everyone kind of has the old cliche of the Zuckerberg hoodie, and then everyone within that sector kind of wants to imitate the innovators and imitate kind of the people they look up to. So you have a whole industry that's kind of characterized by being dressed down. And then, of course, because of the nature of competition within corporate America more broadly, that influences every field.
So the suit, jacket, and T-shirt, are we talking a Sonny Crockett Miami Vice sort of look?
You know, it's funny because that is definitely the point of reference for a certain generation. And I think that point of reference is accurate. I mean, that Sonny Crockett will own that look forever. I think that, you know, whenever Don Johnson passes, I would not be surprised if someone says T-shirt and blazer in that obituary. I mean, it is integral to that character. The thing is that look in its details was very 1980s when you really look at it. The blazer is huge and the T-shirt's kind of scoop neck and it has this very kind of loesch look to it. And it feels very, you know, you can almost like smell the salt air down there in Miami when you're looking at it. And I think now though, what's interesting is that a lot of the kind of details, you know, for men that are trying this look, the T-shirt's a little beefier. The sport coat, it is a little, you know, boxy in cases, or it is a little more relaxed, so to speak, but it's not this big, you know, almost could be an overcoat looking thing like it was with Sonny Crockett. I think that, you know, the point of reference that I kept hearing in these conversations was Eric Clapton in the 1990s, and he wore these kind of very fine, they were often made by Armani, these kind of knit T-shirts and these kind of sport coats that had a very soft shoulder, and it was a look that was pretty, you know, relaxed and easy, but it wasn't very, like, look at me in my cool colors.
Jacob Gallagher of the Wall Street Journal. Coming up, why bus photos are big in Tokyo.
Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, GEICO makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. GEICO.com. Easy.
For bus spotters in Tokyo, the Olympics are all about the journey. Outside the Tokyo Media Center and Olympic venues, amateur photographers are snapping pictures. Not of the people, but the hundreds of buses shuttling foreign journalists, athletes, and officials. You can spot the bus spotters snapping photos of the vehicles labeled with funny names in English, like In a Bus in Haya, Tokyo. Lots of them are labeled with the Japanese word kenko, meaning sightseeing. Why are they doing this? Well, it's a hobby. Bus spotting is like train spotting. Enthusiasts who like to photograph the buses, it's a popular pastime in Hong Kong, Singapore, and other parts of the world. While Tokyo remains in a state of emergency over the pandemic, tourism is not permitted, so the only sightseeing buses moving about are strictly devoted to the Olympics. Some of the bus spotters have been at it for years. They like the buses with the colorful signs on the sides. One guy who's been at it for more than 30 years figures he takes about 1,000 to 2,000 photos of buses every single day. And he doesn't even look at them later. He just likes taking them. That'll do it for this hour. I'm Jennifer Kishinka. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.